Good afternoon and welcome to the June meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our member stations of MPBN, for those of you listening on public radio. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, who's not able to be here today. Mac is the president of the forum. The forum, now in its 31st year, founded in 1983, has been meeting monthly to bring an invited expert from the world of foreign service journalism, diplomacy, American diplomacy, and sometimes the lack thereof, and expose themselves to questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. All of this is covered in detail on our website, midcoastforum.org, where you can find recordings of almost 10 years now of past talks, including, by the way, one from September 21st, 2010. Stephen Kinzer was here then. He's a repeat visitor. He was talking then about the subject of his then latest book, Reset: Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Stephen, our guest today, is the author of 10 books on foreign relations. Now, if you search on Amazon the last name Kinzer, what comes up is not 10 books, but 20 books, 10 on foreign relations, and 10 on soft porn, written by Tonya Kinzer. Now, is that a student? No, just no relationship. Just no relationship. Okay, so the 10 on foreign relations, that's Stephen Kinzer. You've got in front of you or on the web Stephen's particulars, all of his honors, positions he's held, and so forth. I'm not going to talk about that. I want to talk about the books. He writes in the grand style of Barbara Tuchman, that is, history that reads like a great story. And he's done that again and again. He had a book a few years ago, always on insightful topics, a book called Overthrow, A Century of Regime Change, American Regime Change, from Hawaii all the way through to Iraq. How's that for a title? Puppet Governments Are Us is the subtitle, I think. The most recent book, and the one he's here to talk to us about today, is called The Brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles and Their Secret War. It is a terrific story told by a talented, gifted storyteller. Do yourself a favor and pick up a copy and get Stephen to sign it for you. They have, and the books are available out front if you'd like to get a copy. It's not just a good read. But it's also very insightful. You're changed in reading it. In particular, it gives you a very different perspective on a number of different questions. Plutocracy. How did our beautiful democracy become such a plutocracy? Why is American exceptionalism still alive and well when it should have died on the vine? Why does religion, which has a less of a control of the population at large, have an ever greater control of every level of government? Why, given that the communist bloc was going to collapse under its own weight, why were we so terrified of it? Well, if you search each of these questions to its historical root, as Stephen has done, you come face to face with John Foster and Alan Dulles, two outsized personalities, very different from each other, as you'll learn from the book, but outsized, both of them, who had an outsized influence on the America that we have ended up being. So join me in welcoming Stephen Kinzer to tell us about John Foster and Alan Dulles. Stephen.
Thanks so much. It's wonderful to be here. I think this is probably has the most beautiful view of any place I've ever given a speech. Just to clarify on the Amazon story, I can tell you there's another piece which I find much more interesting than Google, than sending in my name. You know, when you go into a bookstore, you find my books in a certain section, like it would be current affairs or politics or modern history or something. And then, of course, they're alphabetical by author, so I've always found myself next to Henry Kissinger. I never liked that. But this time I got a fantastic gift. And it's a gift from Amazon, of all people, not one of my favorite institutions. When you type in the name of my book, you find out that in Amazon, there's no section. So it's every book is alphabetized from A to Z, regardless of category. Therefore, the book that is right next to The Brothers is the Brothers Karamazov. I mean, that's a long way up from Kissinger, so I'm very happy about the little benefit of choosing that title. We're meeting here in the shadow of some very dramatic events in Iraq. We're seeing now something that actually was eminently predictable, although many people are claiming to be shocked that not everybody loves us over there. And I think the shock that we're feeling about what's happening in Iraq reflects something very particular about the way Americans look at the world. We don't expect that our interventions in the world are going to have any long-term effect. In fact, when you use the word long-term, you've essentially lost the attention of anybody in Washington. But actually, when you violently intervene in the political affairs of another country, you're doing something like releasing a wheel from the top of a hill. You can let it go, but you have no control over how it's going to bounce or where it's ultimately going to end up. So the fact that we're surprised by what's happening in Iraq shows us, I think, one of the great weaknesses of our news consciousness. Sometimes, and now that I'm not a newsman anymore, after about 25 years of doing it, I can finally admit in public that I'm not interested in news. Sometimes I think news is a big conspiracy, because news is all about what's happening right now. And there's so much of it that as you absorb it, you forget to ask larger questions than the question, what's happening right now? And in particular, you forget to ask two questions. One is, what happened before? How did we get here? And the other is, what's going to happen tomorrow? What's the effect of what just happened? I'm watching some of those black and white movies on Turner Classic Movies, and I found a line in one of them that I'm not going to write a memoir, I think, but if I ever do, this is going to be the title. Because I found a line that essentially summarizes, I think, my whole career, everything I'm trying to do with all my books. It's from that movie called Arsenic and Old Lace. Some of you may know that movie, so a couple of maiden aunts have a boarding house and they poison the guests. And then Cary Grant is their nephew. He shows up and he figures out what's happening. That's the movie. So there's one scene where one of the aunts says to Cary Grant, oh, the gentleman died because he drank wine that had poison in it. And Cary Grant's eyes pop open and he says, but how did the poison get in the wine? That's the question that I'm trying to address. We look around and see how many wells of poison are disturbing security in the world, and we ask ourselves, how did that poison get in? What happened? So I'm trying to trace back the roots of our global crises. In the CIA, they have a phrase, they call it walking back the cat. So what happened before, and then what happened before that, and before that? When you do that in American foreign policy and try to understand the roots of the situations that have caught us in their grip right now, you find yourself coming back over and over again to the height of the Cold War in the period when John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State and his younger brother Alan was head of the CIA. This was the only time in history that brothers have controlled the overt and the covert sides of American foreign policy. It was an arrangement fraught with danger. They grew up so intimately. They saw the world exactly the same way. They never felt the need to consult anyone other than the two of them. So just a wink and a nod in a hallway and governments would fall. Experts were never consulted. In fact, repeatedly when the Dulles brothers ordered operations to overthrow governments, as in Iran and Guatemala, the CIA station chief told them not to do this. This is going to be a big mistake. And in both cases, Alan Dulles' response was, fine, you're fired. We send in another station chief that doesn't know anything about the country. So the Dulles brothers era, the way they looked at the world, still shapes us today. And I think this is one of the fascinating aspects, for me at least, of their story. It's an interesting dichotomy. So on the one hand, the Dulles brothers are so extraordinary, so remarkable. They really were probably the most extraordinary pair of siblings up to their time that had ever been in American public life. On the other hand, in many ways, they are us. They reflect us. They embody the forces that create us, the way they looked at the world was determined by forces that still shape us and our interface with the rest of the world. So what were those forces? The Dulles brothers grew up in a privileged home. The father was a Presbyterian clergyman. They lived in Watertown, New York, on the shores of Lake Ontario. Every morning in the summertime, the two boys would wake up, and they lived in a parsonage. They have to say their prayers first. They would sing a few hymns, have some breakfast, and then they were free to race down to the lakefront, where they would go out and chase the smallmouth bass with their older relatives. They had a grandfather who had been Secretary of State and an uncle who was also Secretary of State. So their grandfather in particular was a huge influence on them growing up. He was John Watson Foster, who had been Secretary of State in the 1890s. In fact, I figured out that he's the first American Secretary of State to preside over the overthrow of a foreign government, Hawaii. So maybe there's something genetic in the Dulles line there that leads people to a tendency toward overthrowing foreign governments. John Watson Foster had lived the classic American pioneer life in the age of manifest destiny. He had gone to the West, which was then Illinois, faced the heathen savages, built himself a business, ingratiated himself to powerful men, got into politics, won some political appointments, and ultimately became Secretary of State. Now, those fishing trips that Grandfather Foster would take with his two young grandsons were not just about stalking the smallmouth bass. These trips were a cascade of lessons in American history. And John Watson Foster was a great believer in this idea that we call American exceptionalism, the belief that the United States has a providential mission, different from all other countries. It's the belief that we are destined and obligated by fate to go out and share the great insights that we have with the peoples of the rest of the world, and especially with those people who are so backward they don't even realize how much they need our help. So John Watson Foster believed fervently that it was America's mission to go out and spread its system, its approach, its way of life to other peoples. But he would have been thinking about that only within the confines of North America. It took the grandsons to take that to its logical next step. It's actually remarkable when you think of how short is the arc of American history. The grandfather campaigned for Abraham Lincoln, and the grandsons projected American power all over the world in the nuclear age. So that was one great force that created the Dulles brothers, this belief in the providential mission of the United States. It was a time when many people believed that some nations and races were made to rule and others were made to be ruled. And of course, anyone who believes that always puts themselves in the category of the ones that are destined to rule. So this force, I think, is something that's still very powerful with us today. Second force that created them was missionary Calvinism. So the father was a Presbyterian minister, so was the uncle, so was the grandfather, the great uncles, the great great grandfather, the great great uncles. It was a deeply clergy oriented family, but they weren't just clergymen. Many of them were also missionaries. They had a famous grandfather who sailed in an open boat for 120 days to reach Ceylon and preach to the savages there. Missionaries were constant visitors in the Dulles household as they were returning from Syria and China and other places as the kids were growing up. So the missionary environment was very important to them. The particular brand of Calvinism that they absorbed teaches some very specific lessons. One is that there's absolute good and there's absolute evil. There's the right and there's the wrong. There's the correct religion, then there are the wrong religions. If you believe that about religion, it's very simple to take the same schema and put that onto politics, that there's one right way to have a country, then there's all the wrong ways. The right way is ours. The wrong way is the way everybody else does it. So that is an outgrowth of that upbringing. But I think that Calvinist theology teaches you something else. It teaches you that it is not enough for Christians to stay at home and just hope that good triumphs and people in other parts of the world give up their heathen religions and come to the truth. You have to go out there and make it happen. You've got to bring it to them. You've got to push it on them. That's the missionary aspect. And I think the missionary impulse is something that's very strong in American public life. Every time we hear that something terrible is happening, we think, what are we going to do about it? Oh, there's terrible things going on in the world. The girls are being kidnapped in Nigeria, and somebody had acid thrown in her face in Afghanistan for going to school. It's time for America to get involved. What do we do? It's not possible for us to imagine that there are situations unfolding in the world that we don't control. And I think this is part of our shock right now as we're adjusting to the world. We're realizing that the world is being shaped by forces we can't control, and we're not used to that. Now, other people in other cultures don't grow up with this good versus evil idea. In many cultures, people grow up learning that all of us are composed of some good and some evil, and these come out in different proportions according to different situations. But the Dulles brothers did not believe this. They believed there was an absolute good and everything else was absolute evil. And that if they didn't go out and change the world, soon the world would be a place in which humanity could not live, as Foster Dulles famously proclaimed. So that was the second force, this powerful missionary Calvinism. And the third force that shaped the Dulles brothers definitely was their decades of service to the American corporate elite. They absorbed the perspective of giant American multinational corporations during their decades at Sullivan and Cromwell. Now, this law firm was truly a remarkable institution. In fact, even to call it a law firm is quite misleading. They could do some things that law firms do, like if you needed a contract drawn up or you needed to be represented in a courtroom, they could do that. But that's not why people came to Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell had a specialty. It was pushing around small countries to make them do what big American corporations want them to do. And they were the masters of this. Every major American multinational corporation hired Sullivan and Cromwell. And this is the reason they did it. Foster Dulles' very first assignment right out of law school for Sullivan and Cromwell was this. So there was a flour company that had hired Sullivan and Cromwell. They had one problem. They wanted to sell their flour in Guyana. But Guyana had a tariff to protect the local flour manufacturers. So Foster Dulles had to go there and make sure the Guyana government got rid of that tariff. And he succeeded. And the flour from America got into Guyana. The Guyanese flour companies collapsed. And he went on doing things like that for 40 years. He was not a plutocrat himself, but he was one of the most highly paid and most successful servants and courtiers of the plutocrat class. Formed with other members of that class, the Council on Foreign Relations, which at that time was something very potent because the State Department was very small. And Sullivan and Cromwell and the people around it came to have an inordinate influence on American foreign policy. So when the Dulles brothers came into power, they were already used to doing the things that they wound up doing as Secretary of State and head of the CIA. They were already fixed on a certain way that the United States could relate to the rest of the world. So I think these three forces are powerful motivators for the Dulles brothers and also powerful motivators for our own foreign policy today. The idea of American exceptionalism, the missionary instinct, and the concept of foreign policy as shaped principally to serve the interests of giant American investors. Now, one of the fascinating things about the Dulles brothers is that although politically and ideologically they were twins, they saw the world in exactly the same way, yet in their private lives, in their personalities, they were polar opposites. So John Foster Dulles was stiff, arrogant, self-righteous, egocentric, socially awkward. I read somewhere even his friends didn't like him. He was very confrontational. Winston Churchill once described Foster Dulles as the only bull I know who carries his own china shop around with him. The British are such masters of insults. Another future British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, also dealt with Foster Dulles when he was Foreign Secretary. And he had a great observation about Foster Dulles, too. He said, his speech was slow, but it easily kept pace with his thoughts. Alan Dulles was exactly the opposite. Alan Dulles was suave, sophisticated. He was a wine connoisseur. He was a tennis player. He was a fantastic seducer. He had 100 mistresses, from Claire Booth Luce to the Queen of Greece, who used to meet in the CIA headquarters. It was often said that even people who agreed with Foster Dulles wouldn't like him, but that even people who disagreed with everything about Alan Dulles couldn't help but love him. And I think this was important. In those days, people didn't know what the CIA was. Those initials would have been unfamiliar to most Americans. In fact, a journalist once asked Alan Dulles, "What is the CIA?" And Alan replied, "Think of us as the State Department for unfriendly countries." So Alan would show up at these dinner parties and Georgetown cocktail parties, and he was such a sparkling guest that people left thinking, we don't know what the CIA is, we don't know what it does, but if it's run by such a wonderful guy like Alan Dulles, it must be fine. I think that had a lot to do with isolating the CIA from scrutiny during the 1950s. So Alan Dulles was not only the chief of the invisible government, he was the ambassador of the invisible government to the visible government. That was a very important role during that period. Now, in office, the Dulles brothers were engaged in an unending campaign of destabilization around the world. It's one of the theses of my book that we've misunderstood the history of the 1950s. We think of it as a time of peace, tense peace. In fact, the United States, led by the Dulles brothers, was engaged in an unending world war during that time. We didn't see it because it was being waged largely secretly and covertly. And the theater of operations kept changing. It was Iran, Guatemala, Indonesia, India, Egypt, the Congo, Cuba, Vietnam. So that also made it seem like there were all sorts of discrete episodes. We didn't understand how fully they were all tied together. The Dulles brothers never stopped or ended or finished one covert operation without having another one going going immediately afterward. Now, the first two operations that they carried out were results. They were hangovers from their time at Sullivan and Cromwell. I told you that that law firm was hugely successful in pressuring countries to do what their clients wanted. But towards the end of the Dulles brothers' tenure in that firm got two big punches in the face. They suffered two serious reverses. The first thing that happened was that the government of Iran had become democratic, and as a result of elections, the Iranian parliament unanimously had voted to nationalize Iran's oil industry. The oil industry was owned by one big British company, and the bank for that company, the financial agent, was something called the Schroeder Bank, which was a major client of Sullivan and Cromwell. In fact, Alan Dulles on the board of the Schroeder Bank. So he had to go to his fellow board members and say, you hired us to protect your interests in Iran. You just lost your interests. They were not used to having to go into meetings like that. There wasn't anything they could do about it at that moment, but they never forgot that. Very soon afterward, the democratically elected government of Guatemala passed a land reform bill that affected the interests of one of the oldest and most important Sullivan and Cromwell clients, United Fruit. And not only did it affect United Fruit, but United Fruit's banker was also the Schroeder Bank, which of course was a deal that Alan Dulles had organized. So he had to go back to Schroeder Bank, and his brother had to go back to United Fruit and say, we failed you in Guatemala. They didn't forget those two things. They didn't forget those two reverses. And the moment they got into power, they set out, actually before they had even taken their oaths of office, they began plotting against Mossadegh in Iran. And the moment that was finished, they turned their attention to Guatemala. In both of those cases, they were successful in overthrowing a democratic government. And if you look at the subsequent history of those countries, you can really see how the poison got into their wine. Now, the Dulles brothers, as we look back at them, can be seen to have made some major misjudgments. And these are very relevant for us today. The first misjudgment that they made was Foster Dulles's firm belief that you should never talk to your enemies. Do not negotiate. Do not talk. Do not meet. And ultimately, you'll get what you want. The reason for this, as Dulles himself explained, was that the Cold War was based on a paradigm of conflict that required us to believe that we were facing savages who wanted to destroy everything that was decent about human life. If you start negotiating with them, you convey a different impression, which is that these are human beings like us, and maybe they have some ideas, and we'll give them our ideas, and let's see if we can't come up with something like mature adults. That would destroy the entire paradigm of the Cold War on which Foster Dulles depended so heavily. He's the one who had who intensely promoted the air raid drill, civil defense program. It was he who put nuclear tests in the Nevada desert on live television so you could see what the Soviets were going to come and do in your hometown. So never negotiate with your enemies. In 1953, very soon after the Dulles brothers came into office, Stalin died. Soon after that, peace feelers began emerging from the Kremlin. At the end of 1953, there was a summit meeting in Bermuda of what was then called the Big Three, Britain, France, and United States. And on the agenda was a request from the interim Soviet leader Malenkov for a summit that would be the Big Four, so France, Britain, America, and Soviet Union. The French were all for this idea, and Winston Churchill, who represented Britain at that summit, also thought it was a great idea, but Foster Dulles was totally against it, and that summit never happened. So with their insistence on not engaging with rivals and enemies, they may have deepened and prolonged the Cold War in very damaging ways. The second great misjudgment they made was that they totally misunderstood the nature of third world nationalism. When they were in power, they conveyed the idea that the world was being shaped by one great force, and that was a confrontation between the West and the Soviet-led communist world. But many people in the world saw the situation differently. They thought the great force going on in the world was the clash between dozens and dozens of newly emerging countries that were coming out of various forms of colonialism and those forces that were trying to hold them in some form of colonial bondage. So during the 1950s, when the Dulles brothers were in office, you had this spectacular emergence of nationalist movements all over Africa and Asia and Latin America. Foster Dulles looked at the leaders of those movements as enemies because they were something that he hated, and that was the term they used then was neutralists. They didn't want to get involved in the Cold War. So who are we talking about? Well, Mossadegh in Iran, Arbenz in Guatemala, you had Sukarno in Indonesia, UNU in Burma, Nehru in India, Nasser in Egypt, later on, Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. These were people who took over countries that were terribly backward and were totally focused on domestic development. They didn't want to get involved in world affairs. But the Dulles brothers insisted that they do this. And the Dulles brothers never perceived those leaders that I just mentioned as true neutralists. What Foster Dulles thought about those neutralist leaders was this. The Kremlin had realized that there were many countries in the world it couldn't take over right away. So what it did was it placed one of its agents in power in each of these countries and told them, don't tell them you're working for us. Call yourself a neutralist to fool the world, and then when the moment is right, we will call you. Then you clamp down, and your country will go communist overnight. That's how we saw those leaders. This was a complete misreading of one of the great forces of the 20th century. We're still paying for that, for the turning of those leaders into enemies. Because, as I mentioned earlier, Foster Dulles was a great believer in this concept that if you're not on our side, you must be an enemy. And so when he was out fomenting civil war in Indonesia or trying to overthrow Nasser in Egypt, he was fighting what he thought were Soviet agents, but were actually agents of a powerful force that we still have failed to understand, and that is nationalism and the desire of people to control their own countries, their own resources, and their own destinies. The third great misjudgment that the Dulles brothers made certainly is one that's so relevant today as I'm speaking, and that is they had no concept of what we now call blowback. It never occurred to them that their covert operations would have terrible effects years, decades, even generations later. Again, I think this is kind of the short-term thinking that characterizes many of us as we look at foreign policy. So take the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, for example. Seemed like a great success. We got rid of a guy we didn't like, and we replaced him with a guy, the Shah, who would do everything we wanted. So seemed perfect. Well, as we look back on it, it doesn't turn out quite so perfectly. A tremendous amount of history came out of those few weeks in August of 1953 in Tehran. Nobody could have predicted this, but somebody might have stopped to say, we're not able to control the course of history indefinitely, so we should be very careful. And that's exactly why the CIA station chief in Iran told his boss, Alan Dulles, don't do this. So they might have had an excuse on this one. Now, if Alan Dulles and Foster Dulles were standing here today, they might be able to defend themselves by saying, we had no idea that covert operations could have terrible effects 50 years later, because 50 years before us, there hadn't been any covert operations. We just sent the Marines in those days. But we don't have that excuse anymore today. We now understand, particularly as we're reading the headlines from Iraq, what the long-term consequences of our interventions can be. So we don't have the excuse as we begin to plan new interventions that it never occurred to us that these could have terrible unintended effects in the future. Now, when I started out on this project, I visited the one place in America that bears the Dulles name in any substance, and that's Dulles Airport. You know, I'd seen the YouTube video of the bust of John Foster Dulles being unveiled by President Kennedy, and I wanted to go and see the bust. So I went there, and I couldn't find it. And it's a long story. I won't bore you with all the details. I had to make a second trip back, and I was taken down into a closed conference room opposite baggage claim number 3, and there's the bust of Dulles. So I thought this was a remarkable metaphor for how much we've completely forgotten him. I think we've airbrushed Dulles out of our history because their approach to the world, it really didn't work out very well for us. Rather than confront that fact and try to see what lessons we could learn from it, it's easier just to forget that episode ever happened. So I think that's what happened with the Dulles bust. And as a matter of fact, I found that story so cute that I actually put it on page 1 of my book. I start out my book by talking about going to Dulles Airport and looking for the bust and finding it in baggage claim. A couple of weeks ago, I got a phone call from somebody who said to me, you're not going to believe this. I'm standing in Dulles Airport. They've put the bust back. It's back in the airport. I tell you, the power of the press. It's awesome. So I was really thrilled to hear this. I think it must have been as a result of my writing and my talking. Somebody must have said, Jesus, you know, the guy's the person we named the airport after. We got to have his bust at least on public view. But after a few minutes, I began to think, you know, maybe I didn't accomplish something very good because I'm just putting him back in where people can worship him and revere him. I want to get a little table next to the bust where I can sell copies of my book. I'm still working on that one. But I can tell you this. If you haven't seen that bust, from an artistic standpoint, you really haven't missed much. It's not really well executed. He looks kind of bug-eyed and unpleasant. His wife paid for it. I don't think she maybe hired the most talented sculptor. But there is a masterpiece of world art that has portraits of the Dulles brothers right in the middle. This is a fantastic story. It's a 16-foot-long mural on linen painted by the great Mexican muralist Diego Rivera. The name of the picture is Glorious Victory. That's what Dulles called the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala, that it was a glorious victory for freedom and the Guatemalan people. So here's the story behind the picture. When the Americans overthrew Arbenz in Guatemala in June of, was that 60 years ago? Next weekend. Yeah, exactly. There was a huge wave, outburst of anger and rage in all over Latin America. There were protests in front of every American embassy, and American flags were burned and so forth. This was particularly intense in Mexico, which borders on Guatemala, of course. At this time, Diego Rivera's wife, Frida Kahlo, was very ill. She had been ordered by her doctor not to get out of bed. But she was so angry by the overthrow of Arbenz, she told Diego Rivera, I'm getting up and we're going to the protest march. And I've actually found a photograph of Diego Rivera pushing the wheelchair at the front of that protest march with the blanket-shrouded figure of Frida Kahlo in the wheelchair. And she died 11 days later. It was the last time she ever left home. And Diego Rivera then set out to paint glorious victory. I reproduce this picture in the photo section of my book in a kind of pitiful black and white reproduction. But I have stared at that picture so often, I think I know every inch of it. At the very center is John Foster Dulles with a big grin on his face, shaking hands with this Guatemalan army officer who he has just imposed as the new dictator. Behind him is Alan Dulles with a pile of money spilling out of his pockets. In the front, there's a big unexploded bomb with the smiling face of Eisenhower. Guatemalan dead children are littering the front. And then there's laborers bending under the weight of heavy banana stems that they're carrying onto an American freighter with a nice American flag, in case you missed the message. I made a visit to Mexico about a year and a half ago, and I decided, I was in the midst, I was really finishing my book then, I want to go see this picture in real life, not just study it on the internet. So I tried to phone the various Diego Rivera societies and foundations and museums, and I couldn't find it. Nobody seemed to know about it, which puzzled me. I had to go back home, and finally, it was so hard, I actually had to hire somebody in Mexico to figure out the answer to this mystery, and here was the answer. That picture disappeared soon after it was painted. And it disappeared for about 40 years. After the Cold War, a group of Mexican art historians decided to take it on as a project. We got to find Glorious Victory. Does it still exist? And if so, where is it? So here's the story. Diego Rivera was a communist. He donated that picture to the people of the Soviet Union. But the Soviets did not like Diego Rivera because they didn't consider him a good communist. He was one of these Latin Americans who just thought one thing one day, another thing another day, and spoke very freely. So they didn't want anything to do with him. The painting wound up in the basement, in a basement in Warsaw for many years. And finally, I was able to track it down where it is now. It's in the Pushkin Museum in Moscow. So upon learning this, I had to ask myself, am I willing to fly all the way to Moscow for like 1 hour just to go stand in front of this picture? And after a few hours of thinking, I decided, yes, I'm going to do it. So through a long series of complicated maneuvers, I finally established contact with the deputy director of the Pushkin Museum. And he wrote me an email. I think I have it verbatim memorized. The picture that you wish to see, Glorious Victory, is rolled up on a roll in one of our storage basements. If you come to Moscow, I can take you to the basement and show you the roll, but I cannot unroll it because we have no space. So what it means is that this picture is essentially lost. I mean, it's not deteriorating, it's not burned, but nobody can see it, and there's no prospect that anybody will ever see it again. Now, the people who need to see that picture are not in Russia. And the people who need to see it are not in Guatemala because they're fully aware of what happened to them. We're the ones who need to see it. So that's my modest proposal now. Based on our warm friendship with the Soviet leaders these days, or perhaps based on the Soviet leaders' desire that Americans open up their eyes about annexing countries and what we do with places that we don't like, we should get the Russians to send it to us. It should be on some extended loan, and it should be in a place where it's in a proper context, so you could have little panels explaining what's going on and raising questions that people might want to ask themselves about Dulles's, the Dulles era, and American foreign policy. And of course, I have the exact obvious place for it. It should be the centerpiece of Dulles Airport. And that's where I'm going to be selling my books, right next to it. And I hope I'll be able to give some shorter version of this speech to help alert people, not to the fact of what happened so far in the past, but of what lessons we can draw from the past to prevent ourselves from repeating their mistakes in the future. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you for that, Stephen. That was wonderful. I got a bunch of questions and more coming. Assuming the U.S. and Iran could come together on Iraq and Syria, what do you see as a possible blowback or positive outcome?
This is something I've been advocating for years. I feel the United States and Iran have long-term strategic interests in common. The number one strategic existential threat to Iran is jihadism, the Al-Qaeda ideology. They are in a terror. They hate Al-Qaeda more than we do, and let me tell you, Al-Qaeda returns that hatred. They want to kill all Shiites. It's an existential threat for Iran, and they warned us about this over and over. Finally, I hope that we can learn this lesson. We have some partners in the Middle East whose long-term strategic interests clash with ours. Let's face it, what's good for Saudi Arabia in the long run is bad for us. And what's good for us, it's bad for them. We should accept this. Iran, it's different. What's good for Iran in the long run will be good for us. The only reason we haven't been willing to embrace this geopolitical fact has to do with emotion. We're still angry at them. And that anger goes all the way back to the hostage crisis. Emotion is always the enemy of wise statesmanship. And no country in the world shows that more clearly than Iran from the American perspective.
If we were to read older biographies of Foster and Allen Dulles, would they be more respectful than yours?
There was a spate of biographies of the Dulles brothers when they, soon after they left public office, they were quite fawning. More recently, there have been some better studies of them, but in this century, I think there hasn't been any book about them. Really, I feel like they were almost forgotten by most Americans. And in fact, I used to hate the idea that they'd named that airport after them. Now I'm glad, because otherwise, we wouldn't remember that name at all. In fact, when I was writing this book, people, my friends, would say to me, so, what are you writing about? I'd say, I'm writing a book about Dulles. They'd say, the airport? So my answer to that question is that previous biographies could not have done what my biography does because so much of the information that I'm using wasn't available to a previous generation. Only now are we able to piece the parts together and see the big picture. That wasn't possible in a previous generation.
Is there a difference between the Dulleses and, or where do they fit in the spectrum of today's neocons, the Cheneys of the world?
I think that in many ways, Foster Dulles was a predecessor for the modern neocon movement. And actually, if you look through Paul Nitze, you can actually trace the lineage through Team B. Those of you who followed all these backs and forths of the Project for a New American Century, all of this is part of a stream. I think that when I read in my New York Times about this guy named Kagan who wants us to go out and intervene everywhere in the world, it sounds just like Foster Dulles, that we haven't learned anything. We're still thinking, you know, we just didn't stay there long enough. Just give us another couple of years in Iraq. 14 billion. Can we spend 14 and a half billion? That'll do the trick. We're still caught up in this mindset that it's not our approach that's wrong. It's just that we just have gotten a few of the tactics wrong. And if we just keep trying, we're going to get it right.
We've got four questions here about Eisenhower. Eisenhower comes across as kind of a villain in this. We've been used to thinking of Eisenhower as a kindly father figure, but...
I don't mention that in my speech because it's always one of the first questions. Usually it's the first question. What about Eisenhower? Where was he in all of this? And that is actually a fascinating piece of all this. So I entered this project still uncertain about which of these various interpretations to believe. The Dulles brothers bamboozled Eisenhower, they deceived him, or they tricked him, or he wasn't smart enough, or did he know everything? I later concluded in the end that the latter was true, that actually Allen Dulles and Foster Dulles kept Eisenhower totally informed of what they were doing. He knew everything. Every single day, at the end of the day, unless one of them was in another country, Foster Dulles would go over to the White House around 6 o'clock and have a couple of drinks with Eisenhower, and they would talk about the world. And Foster would then be in touch with his brother many times a day, and they would have lunch. So that's how that was the chain of command. Now, Eisenhower was a great believer in covert action and clandestine regime change operations. Why? Well, we don't know for sure because he never admitted that there were covert operations, so he never explained why he supported them. But looking back, I think we can come up with a few guesses. One is that although nobody knew it at the time, covert action played an important role in winning World War II, including the breaking of the Nazi codes and their various other operations. Eisenhower would, of course, have been aware of all of these as the American, as the United commander. So maybe he came away from World War II with an appreciation for covert action. And I think there's another reason. Eisenhower would have seen covert action as a kind of a peace project. Here was a guy that had to send kids off to die by the thousands. This must have weighed on him. And now somebody comes to him and says, I can get rid of that government over there and like 100 people will die. And none of them will be Americans. And it will cost you like $500,000. He would have thought this was fantastic. He's saving huge lives. He's preventing wars. Again, he shared the blind spot of the Dulles brothers in having no concept, no imagination of what might happen decades ahead after operations are launched that seemed successful at the time. Eisenhower, in the summer of 1959, in the summer of 1960, also did two things, or he did one thing twice that, as far as we know, no other president has ever done, which is to order the assassination of a foreign leader. He ordered the assassination of Castro, and he ordered the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. Only one was successful, of course. But the message I took away from this study is that Eisenhower was a pretty tough guy behind that smile.
During World War II, Allen Dulles spent some time in Bern and received a German general. Do you know anything about that? Is that true?
Yes. Allen Dulles was posted as an intelligence agent in Bern, Switzerland, during both wars, First World War, Second World War. During the Second World War, yes, he was involved in a project that actually some later historians have pointed to as something that helped foment the Cold War at the beginning, when U.S. and Russia were still putative allies in Europe. It was Allen's idea that he wanted to try to get the Nazi generals in Italy and Austria, that was the United Command, to surrender, since it was clear that Berlin was collapsing. And he did arrange this. He got them to surrender about a week early. And the general with whom he worked was the number two man in the SS under Himmler, and was also, among other things, responsible for the liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto. So he has hundreds, and was later brought to trial as a war criminal. Allen Dulles helped him get off. Helped him get jobs, and remained faithful to this number two man in the SS his whole life. I can't get past the Bern episode, though, without telling one more story, because this was one of Allen's favorites. We know this story because he used to tell it himself. This was during the First World War. Allen was quite a playboy, as I told you, and it was a Friday afternoon. He had a big date for the weekend. According to one biographer, I'm just quoting, it was with two spectacularly buxom Swiss sisters who had agreed to spend the weekend with him at an inn. So the phone rang as he was leaving, and it was another one of these thickly accented exiles with whom Allen Dulles was dealing every day. And the guy said, I have a message for America. I must speak with America. We must speak right now. So Allen said, fine, you got a message for America? First thing Monday morning, you can come in and tell it to me. The guy said, no, it can't be Monday morning. It has to be now. I got to come now. And they went back, and he kept saying, well, I can't be now because I'm out of here. And they went back and forth, and Alan tells the story in quite a full way. And he never, so Monday comes, the guy doesn't call back. Nothing ever happened. And it wasn't until years later that he figured out who it was. It was Lenin. Lenin had a message for America. It was and the reason he didn't call back was the next day on that Saturday, he went on the sealed train to the Finland station and went back to St. Petersburg to change the course of world history. What was the message? What did he want to tell America? As Alan said, we'll never know.
Should I do it, maybe, was the message. Yeah. Was there a relationship between the Dulles brothers and Senator McCarthy?
So the relationship between the Dulles brothers and Joe McCarthy was very interesting because the relationships were quite different. They responded to McCarthy in different ways. Foster Dulles always wanted to accommodate Joe McCarthy. He had this belief, which he had taken from his friendship with Woodrow Wilson, that secretaries of state always have to deal closely with powerful members of Congress. So Foster Dulles actually hired one of Joe McCarthy's investigators, a former FBI agent who kept a picture of McCarthy on his desk, as the State Department security officer. And that started all these security probes, loyalty checks, and hundreds of people were fired from the State Department during this period as a result of what was considered to be uncertain loyalty. So Foster Dulles knuckled under to McCarthy and allowed McCarthy essentially to run the personnel office of the State Department, which was devastating. It's what led us, for example, to have nobody in the State Department who knew anything about China and could tell us, you know, China and Vietnam, they're not really allies. We didn't find that out until way too late. But we didn't have any expertise because all those people had been fired in the McCarthy purges that Foster Dulles promoted. Allen was different. Allen did not have pressure mounting on him bit by bit. It all came on one day. He got a phone call one day from Roy Cohn, the chief investigator for McCarthy's committee. And Roy Cohn said to him, you've got a person on your staff who has contributed $300 to the Alger Hiss Defense Fund. We want that person down here to testify. So Allen immediately sent him out of town, actually came back home to Manchester by the Sea, and he went up to Capitol Hill to see McCarthy and the other Republicans on the committee. And he told them, you're not going to get any testimony from people in the agency. It's too sensitive. You've got to make an exception for the CIA. And as soon as he got back to his office, he called Vice President Nixon, and he asked Nixon, call Joe McCarthy for me and tell him he's got to let up on the pressure on the CIA. And that happened. After that, McCarthy never bothered the CIA. And so in one way, it was a success. But later on, I came to think that in a way, it was a negative because it reinforced the view in Washington that the CIA was something special and the CIA was something you should never touch.
I've got 14 more questions that we're not going to get to. I'm going to send you home with homework, Stephen.
Usually it's the other way around. I send my students home that way.
But I will end with this one. Suppose they were here in the audience and we handed them a mic, John Foster and Alan. What would they have to say about not just what you said here, but the book?
That's a great question, and I've thought about that. I think I can imagine what their answer would be. And I think it's a little bit similar to what Henry Kissinger would say if I produced a book that talked about, look what happened in Chile, look what happened in Indonesia, look what Cambodia and all. I'm producing a book about a number of the operations that the Dulles brothers carried out. What they would say is, why are you focusing on these meaningless little places like Indonesia and Congo? What about Europe? The Cold War was the main thing going on. We prevented a nuclear war. We kept Europe safe. All that other stuff was just footnotes. Those are details. That was the way they saw the world. You know, Henry Kissinger famously said, I know nothing about nor am I interested in the world south of the Pyrenees. The Dulles brothers were very much like this. Don't forget that the generation that they came from thought of Europe as being essentially the world. They were schooled in diplomacy. They knew about the history of diplomacy, but what did they know? What they really knew was the history of diplomacy in Europe. There you have certain paradigms that are always replaying themselves. Big powers that use smaller powers as their cat's paws, shifting alliances. But the huge issue that was roiling the entire developing world in that time which was the fervent desire of people in poor countries to control their own resources, was never an issue in Europe. That's not part of European history. They would not have even focused on this as a realistic basis for policy. So they would have said, I think in their critique of my book, that I ignored their huge achievement, which was preventing a nuclear war and keeping Europe safe, and instead focused on meaningless episodes that have been blown way out of proportion by history. Now, reading today's newspapers, I think I'd have a good counter-argument to their complaint.
Stephen, I am going to send you back with homework. Go home, write another great book, and come back and tell us about it, please. Stephen Kinzer.
Thank you all.